So on this weekend, there's a retreat happening here. Some people are staying in the monastery and practicing meditation intensely, I think. At least they look intense. I mean, at least they're following the schedule intensely anyway. I don't know what's going on in their mind. Yeah. I'll find out tomorrow. But the whole purpose of meditation, Buddhist meditation, is to try to see things as they really are. I realize this is has two aspects at least. There is the ultimate one. I try to see things as they are, see the ultimate truth, experience the ultimate truth. But it also is relevant relatively too. We begin to see a little bit more the nature of our own mind and body, because it's in the relative that we find the ultimate. Some people they conceptualize the ultimate, you know, it's some special thing or some special place. But the Buddha's understanding was it's right here and now. It's right present all the time. It's imminent. But the you know, the limitation is that most of us aren't able to see it. So the Buddha developed these certain qualities. He realized the benefit of certain qualities, basically collectedness and clarity. And these qualities can be developed to quite a refined degree. Collectedness comes from concentration exercises, and that's usually how most people understand meditation, I think. Developing concentration upon a certain object, and when the mind has some concentration, it's calm and peaceful and no problems. You know, maybe it takes a little longer than that, huh? A few days maybe, before the mind quiets down and it seems to be all the problems have gone. But unfortunately, they have just gone to sleep. They haven't actually been resolved. They've just been mostly, if we raise up one state of mind, say focusing on breathing, and the other states of mind, the turbulent states of mind, the other states of mind we don't pay attention to and don't want to pay attention to, they just fall to the background, fade to the background. And the object, could be a physical object, could be a thought in the mind, which we focus on, give special attention to, rises up into our consciousness. It can become so prominent that it takes over our consciousness. And we have unitary consciousness. It just is that object, just is that thought in the mind. Forget ourselves. The meditator is forgotten, and the object becomes prominent. And occasionally this happens, I think, quite naturally. You know, if you're doing something you like, something you have a lot of interest in, something now the word is passion. I'm following my passion, and then I get totally absorbed in it, and I get unified with it to a certain degree. But the limitation is that, well, we got to come out of it again. Our passion fades, and we're back to just being impassionate or normal. And we're back, then all the other stuff is back again too. If we let go of this meditation object, or we lose our focus, then all the other stuff comes up into the consciousness again. So the Buddha understood this principle, and to him it wasn't working very well, it wasn't leading to ultimate truth, so he tried a different tact. He developed what's called insight meditation, which is learning to see what's going on, develop this quality of awareness or mindfulness, to actually see this process, understand this process. For example, rather than just focusing on a meditation object and experiencing calm, that's one aspect, but then from that, to notice what's coming into it, what's disturbing that calm. We begin to notice what's actually disturbing it, we can learn to disengage, to free ourselves from them, from these disturbances. I mean, again, it's, you know, easier said than done, but that's what the general process is. So as we begin to see things more, see things as they really are, just in a relative sense, when you notice some of these thoughts that come into the mind, I mean, what are they all about anyway? What kind of thoughts come into the mind? You know, thoughts about the future. Well, the future hasn't come yet, has it? You see, it seems so real when you're thinking of it, but it's actually a fantasy. You're just fantasizing about the future. Or memories of the past. It's already gone, finished, sorry. Story over. So we're kind of wasting our time, aren't we? The past is gone, the present hasn't, the future hasn't come yet. There's only the present moment is the only reality, which is what's happening right now. You know, breathing, the odd thought arising, maybe more than the odd one. The even thoughts too. But you can just observe them. They're just thoughts. They're just like the clouds in the sky. They come and they go, they come and they go. They aren't their true nature of mind. You know, maybe sometimes, or some of these thoughts have a certain persistence to them. Maybe they require a little bit more investigation, a little bit more attention. Because they're just one aspect of something much deeper. You know, if you are, do have memories of the past, for example, keep coming up. They keep recurring again and again. I mean, first of all, you can just notice that, okay, memory, and with that understanding, a certain degree of relative understanding anyway, that, you know, they're memories of the past, which is all finished. It's already gone. By knowing this to a certain degree, we can kind of let them go. But maybe they come back again. Yeah, then maybe we get a little bit more attention. Okay, this is, you know, a persistent memory of the past. And maybe that resolves it. Maybe it comes back again. If it comes back again, keeps recurring, then maybe there's something deeper behind it. There's some message that it's trying to tell you, which you aren't ready to receive yet. Usually it's a little bit, one which is a bit humiliating or not too pleasant. So I don't want to receive it yet. It's better just to live in that fantasy world. Just fantasize about that memory, not go to the real source of it, what it's really trying to tell me. But the more that we're able to develop a little bit more collectedness, a little bit more clarity, these qualities, in a way, they begin to, you could say, kind of objectify or depersonalize. Looking at the sensations in this body, for example, or the states of mind, and we begin with a close association with them, looking at my thoughts, the sensations in my body. But as you begin to observe them with a bit more collectedness and clarity, these qualities, then they become just sensations. You know, the my part of it begins to fade away. If you look at some of the thoughts that arise in the mind, if you look at them, you notice the amount of I in it. Huh? I don't like this, I don't want that, I don't want to go here, I don't like this, this isn't right, I don't want that. But as you begin to observe thoughts in general, then that personalized element begins to fade to the background somewhat. When the mind calms down, what calms down is all those personal associations, I this and I that. And the mind does get calm. And it begins to see more universals now, kind of states of mind rather than my particular thoughts. And then we're able to look a little bit more honestly. You know, if they're my thoughts, I don't want to see them, most of them. Well, the intelligent ones, sure, but I don't want to say the stupid ones. Yeah, that's not me. That's obviously not me. But you know, when I begin to look at thoughts in general, well, there are some stupid ones there too. You know, there's intelligent ones, there's stupid ones too. But when they're just thoughts, It's a little bit safer and a little bit easier to do that, just looking at thoughts in general. If I'm looking at my thoughts, then I'm a little bit choosy which ones I look at. So the more that we're able to develop this ability just to observe the nature of phenomena, the more we begin to see how things really are. We begin to see more of the universal patterns behind them. And we start off, in a sense, with the personal elements, very personal, my thoughts, my body, but it can go further and go deeper into the thoughts, and the body, bodily sensations, as universals. And then gradually begin to see the deeper patterns behind them. The meditators over the last day and a half have been giving more emphasis, most emphasis, to trying to be aware of the physical sensations. As I mentioned in the instructions, part of the reason, the advantage of this is that it's a good balance for our mind. Most of us spend so much time using our brain power that that's where our energy is up there. And so we begin to become more aware of, say, some aspects of mind, but not at the expense, maybe, of the physical. Our energy is in the brain rather than the body. When I was first in, I lived in Thailand for 9 years, and especially Ajahn Chah's monastery was in northeast of Thailand, which is a kind of a more undeveloped area of Thailand, and the people in the local village were mostly rice farmers, and it was quite a revelation in a way to be with these people because they had so much natural body awareness. Just when they walk around and where they sit, and in part of Thai culture too, is they're very, very aware of space and proximity. One time by accident, I was a senior monk at the monastery. The abbot was away, and I got stuck there. And normally it's not too difficult, but this day somebody said, oh, the minister's coming, Minister of Agriculture or something is coming to visit. But, oh, no, I don't know all this protocol, you know. We haven't got a red carpet. What am I going to do? They said, just relax. He's coming to, you know, coming to pay respects to the monastery, so he knows it's a forest monastery. So, and then as this group of people were coming towards the hall, I thought, who's the minister? I don't even know his name. Which one is he? And all these people came in, a whole group of them, and this one man sat right there. His wife sat right next to him. The secretary sat next to her. And they all sat down in this particular arrangement, and I knew exactly who the minister was, sitting in the most important position, and the second most important person behind them, and it went like this. They came in, they didn't utter a single word. They just came in, and they all sat down, and exactly in order. So, it made my job easier anyway. I knew who to talk to. Then I noticed some Westerners coming to the monastery. And they kind of come in the front door, and they forget to take their shoes off, and they look around and don't take their hat off, and just kind of stumble in and, hey man, what's happening here? And I kind of, ooh, I'm not one of them. Not a lot of body awareness, and not a lot of spatial awareness either. But one can develop that aspect. One can develop awareness of the bodily sensations and how we move our body through space. We can develop that ability. Not only for social harmony, but this is how we express ourselves. Yeah, I express myself by how I walk into the room and where I sit, and that's expression of myself. And if we can develop a bit more awareness of this particular aspect of our being, we learn about ourselves then. And we can see how kind of arrogant we are. We just kind of barge right in and plunk herself right down in the middle. You can see these tendencies. And maybe we realize that, oh, that's, you know, some of these habit patterns have been a source of, you know, unhappiness or stress or suffering in my life. You know, so we come across these, you know, in a practical way, just by bringing awareness to seeing what's going on, you know, seeing how things really are. Rather than having a kind of a fixed philosophy, you know, Buddhism is about peacefulness or about tranquility or something, and having this ideal and trying to impose that, you know, try to just be aware of what's really happening, the way things really are, relatively. And we continue with this, and we develop it, you know, to a meaningful degree, begin to see the bigger patterns behind it, the ultimates, if you like. And if you're really observing the nature of these thoughts, for example, or physical sensations, you see that these bodily movements, these states of mind arise and they pass away, and they arise and they pass away. If you're observing the breathing, just taking that exercise, observing the breathing process, it seems very simple, just observing the breathing. But in that process, we learn quite a bit about ourselves. For example, you may have noticed already, you try and watch the breathing, and what happens? Where does the mind go? Does it stay on the breathing? It's only half an hour. Half an hour of breathing? Were you aware of the breathing the whole half hour? Anybody? One person? I must admit I failed. I had to think of what to say tonight. But just by that, having that exercise, we learn about states of mind too. We notice the mind wandering off the breathing. And if we understand that's part of the process, being aware of not just the breathing, you know, that's just a point of reference, but we're being, by taking up the exercise, trying to be aware of the way things are, we notice the mind goes off the breathing. And as long as we don't get too compulsive about it and say, oh, get back to the breathing quickly, then we notice where the mind goes. What are the particular tendencies of the mind? Where does it wander to? Is it wandering to the future a lot? Is it wandering to the past a lot? Does it wander to certain places a lot? Something you have on your mind. And then to be able to observe that. I mean, you know, if we didn't have this point of reference of breathing, for example, then for most people, whatever thought comes up, that's it. That's their point of reference. They aren't able to observe it. They aren't able to be the witness of that. They're in it. Taken over by it. But now, by having this neutral object like breathing as a point of reference, you can be the witness. From that point, you can notice the mind's going here, the mind's going there. And now we're the witness of it rather than the getting stuck in it, getting caught in it. So we can come to know then what the mind is actually doing. And the, you know, we begin to observe this a little bit more continuously, we begin to see certain patterns there. I mean, not only do we know about the nature of our mind, each one of our mind is different, and it's different each time too. Sometimes, some evenings, some meditations, your mind's quite quiet. It doesn't wander very far. Other times it wanders a lot. Maybe sometimes it just wanders into sleep, drops into sleep. Other times into restlessness or something. But on one hand, we're learning about these tendencies and seeing, you know, what the effect is. You know, if your mind wanders into the future a lot and just makes you anxious, is it helpful? You know, is that useful for you? To realize that, hey, you know, I don't get any answers. My mind wandering into the future, maybe this and maybe that, and could be this and could be that. I don't find any answers, I just get anxiety out of it. Why do it then? Why bother? It doesn't seem like a very intelligent thing to do. So then you realize that, and okay, you kind of don't encourage that at the very least. Maybe even learn to kind of disengage from it. And you find you have a lot less anxiety and a lot less wandering mind. You find you can abide in the present peace much more. Yeah, some of these states of mind, these habits of mind, they're just habits of mind. They're just habits we've created at some time or other in our history. And most of them aren't that useful anymore. Especially if we see the cause and effect relationships. So we can learn to change them then when we really understand their nature. We don't really understand these cause and effect relationship. And we just have this idea, okay, I shouldn't think about the future, right? You know, I shouldn't think about the future tomorrow. You know, oops. that's something I've got to do tomorrow, not think about the future. Oops, there it goes again, you know. Rather than having it just as a good idea, if we actually see what's going on through the process, through the power of mindfulness, the power of awareness, it exposes it. And then we see that directly, and oh, there is a direct lesson now. I've seen that anxiety, I've felt that, so why do it? It's not a matter of just not doing it, but I see the effect, so I've learned the lesson of that now. And then if we continue with that awareness that of seeing the way things really are on a relative level, you know, we begin to see these patterns. We begin to see that, say, these thoughts, they come and they go. You know, I recognize that as a habit of mind, going into the future, worrying about the future. You know, many years ago I was on a retreat in mountains in Spain. And at that time, I had been the second monk in the monastery in England. And the second monk is the one who usually has to be more a manager role. See. The senior monk does the teaching, and the second one is a manager. So, but Ajahn Sumedho, the abbot, then he realized the manager needs a holiday. Maybe the other people in the monastery need a holiday from the manager. I don't know. He didn't say why he invited me to go to Spain, but but I was up in the mountains and then we had this 10-day retreat. So I thought, wow, this is like a holiday, you know. I just sit there for 10 days, peacefulness. So I sat there the first evening and it was really dull and sleepy. And the second day, I thought, what is this anyway? And it was like there was a big cloud in my head. Big black cloud, and this was Spain, you know, where there's hardly any clouds, you know, sunny every day. But it was a big black cloud in my head, and maybe they brought it from England with me. No. And then one day it was there, and then 2 days it's there. You think, well, this is getting serious. Out of 3 days, it's there. You think, well, you know, if I'm up in the mountains in Spain in the sunshine, at least the cloud should dry out, you know. But this was still there. So when something persists like that, I know there's something behind it. There's something to it. The outward expression of something much deeper, which maybe is a bit uncomfortable to really acknowledge or recognize. 3 days into a retreat and it's still there. This is getting serious. So. Maybe I should follow my own advice and do something. Try and observe what it's about. It's a bit hard to see this in the meditation hall, because the meditation hall, it was a stone building and it was a bit dark too. But when I was doing walking meditation, you know, a bit more active, and the sun was shining and it was bright. And so I began to look at this, what is this cloud, this dark cloud in my head anyway? What is it? And I kind of really tried to go into it and tried to open to it and try to be more, not just aware of it, but more as a process. What is this manifestation? What is this which is manifesting as this cloud in my head? And as I was doing walking meditation back and forth, suddenly the sun came out. The cloud dissolved. And I realized what it was. Then it was all right. You want to know what it was? It was jet lag. No. You know, it's a long way from England to Spain, you know. At least 2 hours on a plane. So no, I realized it was worry. I realized I was carrying this worry about the monastery in England with me. You know, I was a manager, very responsible. See, I was worrying about the monastery in England. And of course, it's worry is not exactly, you know, a politically correct thing to have as a meditator. No. It wasn't very, it was a bit humbling for me to acknowledge I still had worry. But then I could turn it around and say, well, it's not really worry, it's responsibility. I'm being responsible, but it's a responsibility demon is what it was. As soon as I realized that there's this worry there, the cloud disappeared, and then I had the worry now, which was a little bit clearer anyway. It wasn't a black cloud, it was something else. And then there was a bit of a story with that worry. See, it's been going through my whole life, worry. Or response. Well, on the positive side, it was responsibility, but as most of us know, it can become a demon, can it? You know, right there. Responsibility demon over your shoulder, whispering in your ear, what about this? And don't worry about it. Now, here I was in Spain, worrying about the monastery in England. You know, are they getting to work every day? Are they getting this work done? You know, this was totally absurd because it wasn't even a telephone there that I could phone and find out if they're really doing it. So I mean, when I saw this, it was really hilarious, you know, absurd, totally absurd. You know, bring my English worry with me to Spain. But then my mind actually cleared. You know, physically, the cloud cleared, and then it was, you know, then it was another issue about, you know, this issue of worry and responsibility, and which had a different feel about it. You know, at the very least, it was somewhat lighter, you know, because I could actually identify it, recognize it now, and there was some vitality to it. Now, being a bit more clear about that. This cloud in my head, you know, not wanting to recognize worry or responsibility, you know, it has a certain repressiveness to it. I have to deny part of my brain, part of my mind. I don't want to see that. Too humiliating. But then recognizing it, it was quite energizing, actually. Not exactly pleasant, but at least it was real and energizing. And then, now, what to do with that? Then one begins to become a little bit more open to this responsibility and what it does and what its effect it has. And just makes it much more clearer. And it's just beginning to see things as they really are now, at deeper, deeper levels. And I can recognize also behind it all, you know, there is these patterns of, you know, sometimes certain positions, it gets stronger, other times it fades away. You know, if I'm the second monk on the retreat, no responsibility, kind of fades away. But you put me in a position of power and watch out. Now I can talk to my responsibility demon. We have a much better rapport right now. See, so can whisper in my ear. We can have more clear discussion, honest discussion now. So. It's not quite so demonic. But if you keep it hidden, it starts to shout louder and louder. And before you know it, it's screaming. And then you're screaming too. But being able to become more aware of the way things really are, I mean, certainly sometimes it can be a little bit discomforting in a way, because you know, with that principle, trying to be aware of the way things really are, there is a kind of an assumption that we don't see the way things really are. I mean, the Buddha put it down to ignorance, and it's a useful word in English anyway. Ignorance is kind of the root source of our suffering, because this is a habit of ignoring. If we keep, we have a habit of ignoring reality, ignoring the way things are, we ignore them, then it becomes ignorance. The whole principle of ignoring, which is active, becomes actually a fixed habit of now ignorance as a way of being. And then mindfulness, awareness, just is a way of unraveling that now. Being more aware of what's going on, we cease to ignore things, ignore what's going on in the mind and body, and we begin to unravel that and in a way disengage from that tendency. And so ignorance gets transformed then. In a way, it's learning to unpack that ignorance, that habit of ignorance, unpack it with mindfulness and awareness now. As we do that, we discover more and more aspects of ourself, many more hidden aspects of ourself. And it's only by actually opening up to them, by going into them, becoming more aware of them, that we see through them. The whole nature of ignorance, another aspect of it, is that we see things, we see reality as a thing. We think my mind is a thing. Can you actually show us your mind? What is the mind rather than the movement of mental processes? We look at this body, we think, oh, this is the body here, this is my body. But what is the body besides, you know, these processes going on? Breathing, drinking, eating, excreting. There's these physical processes that are going on. The body is not like this, well, even this clock is a process too. I'm sure there's something going on. There's a battery in there doing movements, you know. When I was in Switzerland, they had lots of Swiss clocks. They have all these moving dials and things, so you really see it as this movement, but these things, you're not quite sure, but the numbers are moving. So it's still alive. It's not breathing, but it's still working. But when you begin to observe the body, for example, bodily sensations, you begin to see more processes here. These are processes. So, for example, when there is some discomfort, some suffering in the body, most people, they grab hold of it and say, oh, I don't want that. You know, some pain arises, and then you grab hold of it and say, I don't want the pain there. And then you fix it. And actually, my experience is that for many people, most of the pain is the resistance to it. It's grasping it and resisting it. That creates more pain. When if you recognize this is a process now, you know, there's a process. And you look at this, and then maybe you can observe that this so-called pain, it's got energy to it. You know, it's a throbbing pain, it's a pulsing pain. You know? And if you can go with it a bit and breathe into it, give it some more life, it begins to be a bit different. It's a bit more dynamic. And sometimes it gets softer and sometimes it even goes away. Because it's not the pain itself, it's all the fear and resistance to it, which is the real pain. And the same with the states of mind, you know, these. So you unpleasant or uncomfortable states of mind arise, and what most of us do is we grab hold of them. Oh, they don't want that. And what before, in true nature, is just processes, movement. The movement of mental processes is the mind. We grab hold of it, and you turn it into an object. Now you try and fight with it and try and destroy it, and it's not going to work. Whereas if you recognize that it's a process, then some of these states of mind you just allow to arise and fade away. You don't grab hold of them. You just recognize them. It's like that cloud in my head. You know, if I held on to it and said, "Oh, I've got a cloud in my head now. It's probably a brain tumor." You know, it's a permanent entity. I'd be a cloud head for the rest of my life. But at least I knew intellectually that it's part of a process. Then one can relate to it in a bit more of an open, a bit more processive way and kind of tease it out a bit. allow it to be a bit more flowing and flexible. And some of these states of mind, like the old habits, you know, they're old habits and we're holding on to them. And if we can relax our grip on them, some of them just fade away, you know, physically, mentally. Other ones, they maybe require a little bit more deeper investigation because the holding on, the identification, the holding on, the grasping is a bit deeper. You know, the reason there was this cloud in my head, it was holding on to the responsibility demon. Not till we get to that level does that dissolve, you know, the cloud dissolve. If I try to release the grip on this cloud itself, you know, try and negotiate it or try and deal with it, it's missing the point because it's not relating to the source, the very root of it. That's just the shadow of it, just the image of it. It's like somebody shadow boxing, you know, looking at the shadow on the wall and trying to fight with that, and you just go over and turn the light off. you're boxing with yourself because the light's on behind you. You know. Just turn the light off and there's no shadow to fight with. But sometimes, you know, being able to observe more clearly the true nature in a relative sense, this gives us an opening, you know, recognizing, okay, there is this particular state of mind here. You know, now what's its true nature? And we try and follow it back. Other times we know to some degree the more ultimate nature of things is processive. Things are always changing, arising and passing away. So, you know, bringing that into the picture allows us a little bit more flexibility or adaptability to relate to these things. I mean, it's easy enough to say, oh yes, my anger is an impermanent thing, you know, I know that, yes, but I still get angry. You know. We can have that as a kind of a theory, but now how to relate to it in a practical way. You know, begin to open to that expression of anger, for example, and as you begin to open to it a bit more, you begin to see through it. You know, it's an energy. Get back to the energy level of it. You know, if we hold on to it and we deny it or don't like it or think it shouldn't be there, we give it a fixidity to it. Yeah. Fixidity? Is that a word? Good enough. You understand. I used to make up words in Germany too, in Switzerland with German, but they didn't laugh at it though. I have my own dialect. You know, but then we realize that, you know, practically some of these old habits, they are changeable, they are flexible, they are fluid. But now how to go into them and relate to them in that way, practically, bringing more awareness, you know, how does that express itself physically? You know, what are the mental expressions of it? Back to the body again. You begin to tease it out a little bit more in its processive nature. And you begin to see in a practical way how it can kind of loosen up a little bit. You know, maybe the traces of something like anger and that are there, you know, but it's not quite so predictable, not quite so rigid, quite so fixed. You can recognize that, you know, it's opening up more, becoming much more in the true nature of things, more impermanent, more changeable, more fluid. So we'd be able to work back and forth, you know, from the ultimate to the relative. I mean, the relative and the ultimate are here all the time. And if we try to approach it from just one angle and say, oh yes, it's all impermanent, it's all changeable, you know, it's just being too idealistic, just having a high ideal, but practically, relatively speaking, it still goes on. You know, I know my anger is impermanent, but rah. But my anger is impermanent, but the button is pretty permanent. If I just get rid of that button now, my anger would go away, right? But you have to be able to be relative and ultimate, you know, so they work together. I mean, I realize some people, they contrast these two. You know, enlightenment's up there somewhere and the world's down here somewhere, and you never bring the two together. You know, enlightenment is right here. You know, where else is it? Well, maybe it's behind me at the moment. The Buddha was enlightened with his body and mind. He didn't have to go off to Mars to be enlightened. You know, some people believe that, actually. There's some strange ideas, but there's one group that believed the Buddha's on Mars. See? That went to Mars to get enlightened, and then he comes back and gave back in Mars again. See? I don't believe that myself. That's not Theravada Buddhism. It's Martian Buddhism. So many pretty Martians are here that you've got your own religion. But we say the Buddha was enlightened in this world and enlightened on the earth. So, you know, he had this body-mind, just as we have body-mind. So that's where it happens, within this body and mind. And maybe not in India under the Bodhi tree, maybe it happens in New Zealand under the Kauri tree. Who knows? Maybe the next Buddha won't be born in New Zealand. Well, not the next one, maybe the one after. You never know, it's always changing. The purpose of Buddhist meditation, to be able to see things as they really are, and we apply this to all of these experiences we have. See more clearly as they really are. You know? And some people say, well, how do you know how they really are? Well, until you arrive at the ultimate, you're not quite sure yet. Yeah? We begin to observe these changing phenomena that make up this body-mind. You just have to have a certain confidence that, you know, and you begin to see the results yourself. Yeah? If you begin to observe more clearly the nature of body-mind, you begin to flow with it a bit more. Yeah? Begin to flow with the nature of body because you're seeing it clearly, more and more clearly. And you don't have to wait for an ultimate experience of how the body ultimately is. But the more we increase our relative awareness of the body, we begin to flow with it a bit more. We can be more present with it, and with your mind as well. When we begin to know our mind, we aren't fooled by our mind so much anymore. When you begin to see some of these, you know, thoughts come in, they find yourself, you know, worrying about the future, you notice that? No. There that is again. Okay, drop that one. You begin to see it more and more clearly, and you find more and more space in your mind, more and more peace, and you see it's working. You begin to see that it's, you know, by being aware of the way things really are, it does give results directly. Don't have to wait for the ultimate, but gradually through the increasing this awareness of the relative way things really are, you see for yourself direct results. But the Buddha's teaching, as we actually say in the chanting, it's being realized each person for himself. You know, and it's leading ever onward. And we get a little taste of it, and it leads us onward to, you know, deeper and deeper realizations. You don't have to just wait for, you know, to get to heaven or something, or wait for the ultimate, but it's happening continuously in an everyday practical way. So being able to deepen this process, and sometimes maybe it's a bit hard to actually see the process working, you know, but bringing more awareness to what's actually going on in our life, if we continue with it, we begin to see clearer and clearer, opening up to these areas of our experience which we're not so clear about, or maybe even in the dark about, or ignorant about, but being more aware of them slowly. So he begins to bring light into those dark places of our mind. And if you continue with that, it's enlightenment, huh? Completely, ultimately. Sometime, somewhere, or somebody. So I think I better pause there.